John. I'm Mark. This is the web show where we endorse one awesome book. This week, our special guest, Sean Cranberry, is enthusiastic about two graphic novels, Sonia Hilaire's The Selves and Joshua Dyehart's Unknown Soldier. Sean is the Johnny Fever of literature. He broadcasts on CJSF Radio and from booksontheradio.ca. But before we get to Sean's recommendations, John, my erstwhile co-host, has come into possession of a digital reading device. John, let's talk about this newfangled gadget of yours.
Well, it's not even newfangled. It's oldfangled. You can't even get what I got anymore because it's a hand-me-down. My dad, who's like the early adopter in the family, right? Because, you know, he's got time and money. He got the new iPad, so I got his old PRS-505, the Sony e-reader from about a year and a half ago.
So, that says it all right there.
We are cutting edge. We're cutting edge here on the Enthusiastic Cast.
So what I wanted to talk about in terms of e-readers, when I like sat down to think about, you know, what I wanted to say about them, I basically had to like carve off all the things that I didn't want to talk about, right? Like, I don't want to talk about, you know, kind of a consumer electronics view. I don't want to talk about which device is better. I don't want to talk about just sort of the big picture e-books versus paper books and the, you know, the digital age and all that, or EPUB standard versus proprietary formats, or DRM, or ebook pricing, or windowing, or any of that. I just wanted to sort of look at, you know, carving off the iPad, because I think that the dollars and cents cost benefit ratio of an iPad is so much different from the regular dedicated e-reader, right? Like in Canada, we've basically got the Sony Digital Reader, which is the newer version of what I have. The Sony Reader Pocket Edition, which is about $199. Then you've got the Kobo, which is $149. And you can also get the Kindle for $189 US plus a cross-border fee. So I think it works out to about 250 Canadian after taxes. So,
and those are the new prices, right? Those are the after the rollback or whatever that just happened?
Yes, because it was, I think it was $259.99, and then they dropped it to in the States, and then we just benefit from that to compete with the Nook, which was rolled out at $199.99. Right. And of course, Borders is going to be adopting the Kobo in a few months, which, you know, based on the Canadian pricing, they're probably going to go $179.99 or US, or probably even cheaper, probably like $139 or $129. Mm-hmm. And then that's when things are going to heat up. But basically, you know, you've got your iPads, which is up, you know, between $500 and $1,000, depending on the package you get. And then you've got a dedicated e-reader from somewhere from like $175 to $250 Canadian, all in with taxes. So just looking at those, it was like the question was, is it worth it? And what are sort of like, you know, the metrics for deciding whether or not it's worth it? For me, it was interesting because I had to kind of carve out, like, I'm a heavy reader. A lot of that is graphic novels, and the e-reader is not going to help me with that. You know, I read a lot of graphic novels. Of course, you know, dedicated e-reader is not going to help me with that. And, you know, even though I read about, you know, 50 prose books a year, I'd say about 10 of those are audiobooks, 10 of them are gifts, 10 are from the library, and 10 are just books that people, you know, give me because, you know, we just share a lot of books. So even though I'm a heavy reader, I'm probably only buying about 10 to 15 books, making actual, you know, purchases with my own money, 10 to 15 books a year. And the price differential between e-versions and paper versions is not so great that this is going to amortize very, very quickly on just a purely economic scale. I was looking around at some price differences, and you've got a decent range on new hardcovers. Like, I looked up The Passage by Justin Cronin and The Help by Catherine Stockett. And depending on where you shop, you're looking at about $5 to $7 savings going with the e-version over the paper version. But then when you get down to like mass market paperbacks, I looked up The City and the City by China Miéville, which is something we were enthusiastic about a few weeks ago, and The Killing Floor by Lee Childs. And you get down to like, you know, $2, $3 difference between the e-version and the paper version. Mm-hmm. So expecting that, you know, to get that $200 back in savings, it's going to take about 4 years. And as I just demonstrated by the fact that you can't even get the thing that I got, which is only a year and a half old, like 4 years is a long time in this day and age to hold on to a piece of tech. So it's not, so you're really just spending that money. That's not an investment in future savings. So what it really just comes down to is it's only about 7 ounces. All of them are about 7 ounces. I think the, or 220 grams, depending on, you know, how you measure things. The Kindle's a little bit heavier, but they're all about the same size, about the same weight. And that is small and light. And for me, who's a commuter reader, that's great. And so that's a benefit right there. And then also, you know, I've got a house which is rapidly running out of room in which to store paper books. So the fact that these e-editions aren't taking up any physical footprint in my house is also kind of a bonus, offset by the fact that I can't pass these on and loan them out to anybody. And I'm obviously getting back to, you know, the economics of it. I'm not going to recoup anything by selling these to a used bookstore or at a garage sale or whatever if I chose to do that.
Do you want to talk about the SAF, the spousal approval factor of such a device?
Well, the makes a great gift. I got mine for free, so obviously the spousal approval factor of free is high. And so the other big benefit is, again, mine's all tricked out, courtesy of my pop. So one of the accessories that I have is a slip cover for the ebook that also has a glass plate that goes over the reading area so that, you know, you can read in the dark and you can read in bed without, you know, keeping your wife up. It's got a very low light footprint, you know, much less than you'd get on a bedside lamp or something like that. But the fact of the matter is that you can get one of those little book lights that clips onto a paper book and does basically the same thing. So I don't know if I would extol that as one of the massive virtues of the ebook over paper books. And of course it costs a lot more than the little book light that you clip onto your paper book. So ultimately for me, it's 220 grams. Carrying that around, even if it's only, 20% of my reading time, that's got that carries a lot of weight with me, ironically. And so that, and probably the lack of having books just stacking up all around me, probably makes the $200 worth it, even if it's a device that I'm only going to use for a couple of years. But that's me, and I don't know how that math stacks up for the general public. Right.
Sean, in the past, we've talked poetry, we've talked novels. I had no idea you're a big comic book guy. And
Yeah, for sure.
Here you are, and you want to endorse two graphic novels. Why don't we get into that then? Like,
sure. So we'll start with what do we want to start? Let me start with Sonia Ahlers because it's the real mind blowing example. Sonia Ahlers is, I don't know where she's from. She spends a lot of time in Toronto, got a lot of friends in Toronto. She did the design for Lisa Foad's book called The Night is a Mouth, which came out about a year and a half ago, maybe a little longer than that. But she's also done, had a couple of books published, one by Insomniac Press called Fatal Distraction, which is the first book that I came to know about her. And it's very, very personal, very graphic art and poetry and a lot of appropriated images, very kind of whimsical. I hesitate to describe it too much because I think it really is just a very poetic, collision of text and image and found image and hand-drawn image and rabbits. And Sonia is just a really great artist. And I remember when Fatal Distraction came out, I was at the Virgin store and people were all over it and people loved her style. And she was living in Vancouver at the time. And I didn't get it. You know, I think if you take a look at the book, you'll see that it's really, really very poetic and very strange. And, you know, I got to know Sonia. We did some work together, put on an exhibition of some of her stuff in another bookstore that I was working at. And over time, she told me that she had got in touch or Quillen or what? Wait a minute. What's her name?
Drawn and Quarterly?
Yeah. D&Q had gotten in touch with her and said, we love your stuff and do you want to do something? And of course, she was like traveling in Mexico or something and immediately took a beeline to Montreal to go demand that or say yes, essentially. So, you know, that was a couple of years ago, and she sequestered herself in like Dawson City, I think, for about 18 months, and went through all of her like incredible archives and the stuff that she continues to create. She created this book, and I've worked in the book industry since 89. I've been a bookseller forever. And ever since about 2002 or so, I really kind of got into graphic novels and kind of graphic storytelling. And I really kind of began to understand the appeal. And this book, The Selves, is, I think, probably one of the most genre-bending and important books released by a Canadian publisher and created by a Canadian writer and artist this year. I'd put it up against anybody. The quality of the images that Sonia has created are incredible. And that's not to say that they're all hers. She has included some other images from some friends of hers, but they're like this amazing amalgam of cutouts from magazines. There's a whole subtext involving Marilyn Monroe and her ability, her like unsung kind of ability as one of the great readers of the past century. And there's like text from Gloria Steinem. It's a very, very heavy feminine book. And I love it. I think she totally blows the doors off all kinds of storytelling and poetic and image based ways of telling stories. She like just plain fucking steals images, steals text. There's a whole bit here that she's just an entire paragraph that she's lifted from Cat's Eye by Margaret Atwood. There's another one that she's lifted from a Steinem book. She's like, I don't give a shit. She doesn't care about these notions of copyright. She's appropriating it for art and to tell a story. And it's an amazing book. And I can't really say enough. I think if somebody came up to me as a bookseller and was like, so, you know, I know a young woman, she's kind of fucked up and she's got some artistic sensibilities and she loves rock and roll and do you have anything that might really appeal for her? And I would just grab this book and say, this is the one, man. This is what you need.
So that's not half measures. So that's saying that this is the most important book published by a Canadian publisher this year? Yeah. So how are you going to follow that up? What are you going to say about the second book?
Yeah, well, you know what? I think it is. I think that when we look back on this time and we forget about like the notions of that books have to be stories, they have to be novels or nonfiction books written by Malcolm Gladwell, then and you look at just pure artistic expression and somebody having something really original to say and a publisher that knows that there's a real voice. And that they just kind of stood out of her way and let her make an amazing book. Then I will, you know what? I'll defend this. I'll defend this book. I think it really is one of the best books released this year. But it, you know, it's a weird piece of art. So I'm under no illusions about whether anyone's going to agree with me or not.
Right. But you know what? I think you've couched that, you know, like sufficiently well, right? It's, you know, it moves you and it speaks to you and it's powerful for you. But I think by saying, you know, it's for a fucked up girl who's into rock and roll and it's a weird piece of art. If you are not, if you as an audience member are the kind of, you know, that that's just not going to fly with you, then, you know, your mileage may vary. Take as forewarned.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it's important to not bullshit your audience, right? Like, you know, when you're, when, how many book reviews have we all read that are just, that are using the weakest terminology and are retreading, you know, it's a tour de force, or, you know, like, using language that just says nothing. And I think that, you know, even if you take something like, just to go back to Martin Amis's book, you look at that and you're like, you know what, this, you know, it's Martin Amis for one, so you know what you're going to get. And he's a really great writer, so you know you're going to get that. And it's in hardcover, so you know it's going to weigh a ton, unless you buy the, you know, the ebook. and you know what you're going to get. So, you know, if you want to delve into it as a reviewer, if you want to delve into the minutiae of the Amis canon and compare and contrast, that's one thing. But, you know, I think with this book, I know Sonia personally, so, you know, maybe I should disclose that, but this book is such a huge step towards the fruition of the vision that she had on her previous books. You know, I mean, we've all read books like that where, you know, like early John Irving or something like that, where you're like, this is really good storytelling, but, you know, it's really good. And then he releases something like Garp or what's the other one? Prayer for Owen Meany or something like that. And it just blows your mind because all of that potential is realized, right? And that's how I feel about this book. I really think that she's got something to say and she's finally figured out how to say it. And I think it's important to recognize that. And it's not just your average novel. So that's why I stuck behind that.
Sweet. Okay, so let's move on to The Unknown Soldier then. Or is it The or just Unknown?
Yeah, it's Unknown Soldier. And John, you might know a little bit more about the history of Unknown Soldier, because I believe it was a classic old comic story from maybe even the 50s and the 60s, maybe kind of, is it a Korean War story, or do you know?
I don't know exactly what war. It's slightly before my time, but it was sort of the heyday of war comics from DC. It was like when Joe Kubert was doing Sergeant Rock.
Yeah, Sergeant Rock.
You know, the Haunted Tank, all that stuff. And the deal was he was just, you know, a soldier with his head wrapped in bandages. So you never knew who he was. Mm-hmm. And he just, you know, had war-based adventures and kicked ass. And then it kind of got – so like DC Comics has the Vertigo imprint, which is their quote-unquote mature readers imprint.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Back in – I don't know when it was. It was like the early – to mid-90s, like 93, 94, Garth Ennis, who is probably most famous for doing Preacher and a bunch of other stuff. It kind of got, at that time, Vertigo was basically churning over the DC backlist, right? Like everything that they had a copyright on that wasn't being actively used in the superhero universe got turned into, got re-envisioned in sort of a grim and gritty way. And turned into a Vertigo property. So they did Shade the Changing Man and a bunch of other stuff. And one of them was a miniseries by Garth Ennis and the artist Killian Plunkett, which was The Unknown Soldier. And so that's how it ended up in the Vertigo stable. And their take was kind of a paranoid, you know, basically the Unknown Soldier was basically this shadowy figure. He was like, you know, he was on the grassy knoll. He was the guy basically, you know, killing the people for the man since whenever. But I don't know how that tags up to this new version, which is just this past year, right? Like 2008, 2009?
Yeah. Well, it's been in the cooker for a while. Like I know, again, I didn't plan on this, but I know Josh Dysart, the writer. We worked together on the Avril Lavigne manga comic that we managed to put together for Random House about 4 years ago.
What was that called? Like Four Wishes or something like that?
It was called Make Five Wishes.
Okay.
I think, yeah, it was called Make Five, Avril Lavigne's Make Five Wishes. And we had this deal with Network, which was Avril's label, or at least her management group. RCA was the label, and with Random House as a result. It's a much longer story than that, but through one way or another, Josh Dysart ended up coming on board as our storyteller. And he wrote that, and the story is great. And it's just, it ends on such a tragic note. It's really it's really kind of funny. Most people didn't read it simply because Avril Lavigne was associated with it. But if you can stomach that, it's actually not bad. But
it's one of those licensed properties where there's actually like, you know, a really great piece of work being hidden under the license.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, we worked with her. I mean, she had to okay every aspect of the story, which is not like she was a micromanager by any stretch. She was just like, so what's the story? It's about a girl who has an imaginary friend that looks like me. Okay, fine. And that was that, right?
Right.
And then we didn't actually tell her that her friend committed suicide at the end. Whatever. Just a minor detail. But during that time, during the creation of that project, which was a nightmare in many respects and a huge learning experience in many others, Josh went to Uganda in Africa and ended up kind of starting in inadvertently on the idea, the research for this story, which is essentially, Uganda has been in kind of constant turmoil since, I guess, the Europeans, the British rolled through missionaries kind of civilized them all once upon a time. And then there's been various mutations in terms of militancy and something called the LRC, which is like the Lord's Resistance Army, which is essentially a roving band of young children that are heavily armed. And a couple of cronies at the top who have this kind of weird, twisted Christian missionary philosophy and way of keeping these kids enthralled by the mission, which is essentially to roam around Uganda and take or kill more converts along the way. And it's this weird story. Anyway, so Josh was in Uganda. He came back, talked to DC, who had published some of his other stuff, and they recently published his new book, is a hardcover edition, graphic novel version of Greendale by Neil Young. So he just worked with Neil Young for the past 3 or 4 years.
I knew the name was familiar because I've been hearing a lot about Greendale.
Yeah, exactly. And it looks amazing. The art looks incredible. And
yeah, I think it's Mike Norton that he got to do the art on that.
I don't know off the top of my head.
I've been hearing just a ton about that book. Okay.
Yeah. So. Yeah. So anyway, so this is his book from last year, and it's won like every single prize. Like I think it came short on what's the big graphic novel? The Eisner?
The Eisners, yeah.
Yeah, it was shortlisted for the Eisner, but it didn't win, but it won everything else. And it was on the front page of the New York Times book review for a graphic novel, which I think is maybe only happened once, and that was Mouse or something. And it's a really, really, really great story. Josh's storytelling, he just like pulls no punches with the language and with his ability to confront just absolute violence. And then the artist in this one is Alberto Ponticelli, who does an amazing job, like just like unflinching violence, which is not the reason to read the story, but coupled with Josh's great ability to characterize and his great ability to render in very short kind of speech bubbles by the characters just right. to move the story along. It's amazing. And the first two trade editions are available now, and I highly recommend them, especially for people who think that even though they might be familiar with Preacher or Transmetropolitan or whatever, or the Vertigo imprint, but still might think that graphic novels aren't capable of being like literate, you know. I would say that they should really go and check out Unknown Soldier. Like if somebody walked into a bookstore and was like, well, you know, I gotta buy a gift and it's for a male, you know, in his late teens, early 20s, and he's pretty mature and he still likes comic books, but he also is really intelligent. I'd say, you know what, here you go. This is the one, you know, read it.
Right on. Right on. How does the Because, I mean, it started out, obviously, as a genre piece, as a war comic, mm-hmm. And very much in the, you know, here's the hero of the piece, look at him, you know, really mm-hmm. effectively kill the bad guys. How does that, or does that play into this kind of reboot? Or
well, he's hidden, right? I mean, he really is unknown, even though you're introduced to him. It's really clever. And a lot of the things about the stuff that Josh does, I really like. Because he's so conscious, and I've had this conversation with him over, a couple of beers, and he's super conscious of the fact that he needs, because he wrote the Swamp Thing, right? Like, I mean, he took on the great mantle of the Swamp Thing from Alan Moore and yeah. other important comics writers. He wrote at least an arc and a half of the Swamp Thing. So he's like, you know, you have to be super conscious of the those that have come before you and the storytelling that they have done, and you need to be able to infuse these stories with a respect for where they've come from, but you have to also tell it in a fresh way. And so what he does is he introduces the unknown soldier on page one, and you know. It's that pathetic fallacy thing, I think is what it's called. Like, you, is that pathetic fallacy or something else? Dramatic irony, where you know who the unknown soldier is, but nobody else in the story does, right?
Right.
And I guess that gives you a kind of voyeuristic kind of input into how the story develops, and you get to see all of those tensions in the way that the soldier interacts with even his wife, who doesn't even know where he is anymore after page five, because he's disappeared into the wilderness to kind of avenge his people, really, and to take on the Lord's Resistance Army, and there's a lot of heart too. I mean, there's a lot of emotion. I don't want to like portray it as this like, you know, kind of like RoboCop guy goes out and seeks revenge, and that's all it is. There's a really deep story about not only about Uganda and it's all of its political ridiculousness, which you can't even begin to put into words. Certainly, I can't. There's a lot going on in here besides that
sounds super. I'm totally going to pick that up.
Yeah, you should, man. I mean, Vertigo killed it, actually.
I know it got canceled, but it's a tough market right now. That's not any reflection on the quality of the book. A lot of stuff is dying.
Yeah, no, exactly.
All right. I think that might be a good place to wrap it up.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. It was a great conversation.
Well, dude, man. Okay, so...
You're welcome back anytime, man. That was awesome.
Yeah, you fucking hit it out of the park for sure. Is there anything you want to plug, or do you want to, like, tell people where they can find you on Twitter, or, like, do you want to talk about a little bit more about what you're doing and what's going on, or...
Sure. Well, I mean, it's weird, right? Because it's supposed to be summer, but, I mean, like... So what we're doing, there's lots of things going on, actually. So Books on the Radio is kind of in a pupating, kind of transformative stage. I brought on about 7 or 8 or 9 new writers who are all local in Vancouver, and a couple are actually back out towards Toronto. And they what we're doing is we're redesigning the website, and we're making it, we're embiggening it a little bit, and so there's going to be more people who are going to be doing more reviews and interviews and talking and creating more content for the site, so that hopefully, you know, we can do a better job of making people aware of the cool books that are out there and talking to people who are interesting to talk to. Because I hit a wall sometime earlier this year when I was like, man, there are so many cool books, and I'm receiving so many cool books in the mail, and there are so many books that I haven't even got to yet that I want to do, that I need more people. So we're doing that. We've got a couple of partnerships that are really, really exciting that we've, this will be the first announcement, I guess, of the partnership with Open Book Toronto. And so we'll be sharing content with those guys, and I'll be doing once a month a unique Open Book Toronto Books on the Radio interview just strictly for the Open Book Toronto site and strictly for people who are working and writing and creating or doing something interesting in Toronto. And that's really, really cool because I love Amy and Clelia, and I think those guys are awesome, and I'm happy to be working with them. And we're also got a partnership with Geist Magazine where we're going to do some content sharing and creation and some other stuff. So Books on the Radio is growing and it kind of blossoming into something else, and we'll see whatever that turns into. Talking with Julie Wilson, and we're kicking around ideas for what we're going to do with the Advent Book Blog. And there are some ideas about the Advent Book Wiki and creating a wiki for books and writers and ideas and creators in Canada and all over the world that are relevant and maybe non-traditional or whatever. And then we're talking, and you know, just before you called, I fired off the email to Monique Trache and John Maxwell at Simon Fraser University's publishing program. And I was just prodding those guys to get on the ball with BookCamp Vancouver. So the date is set for BookCamp Vancouver. The food has been ordered. and that's October 1st. It's a Friday. And I think we're planning, the whole day will be BookCamp Vancouver. I think our themes are going to be geared towards open source and kind of post-territorial ideas about dissemination and marketing. Those are at least the ideas that I would like to see us engage. I'm hoping that what we can do is for people who are coming from out of town or might be flying in from Toronto or thinking about it, is to add a second day on Saturday to kind of justify the expense of coming out, where it would be just a really loose kind of day spent getting to know one another and doing some really kind of informal things in the city. And if it's early on in October, we might still have some good weather. So we might be able to like do something like hit Stanley Park and really check out Vancouver and really like dig what Vancouver is all about. So those are some of the things that I'm working on and that we're working towards.
So what's your Twitter handle?
Twitter handle is, I've got two. One is Sean Cranberry, SeanCranBury. That with the at sign in front of it. And then the Books on the Radio handle is @BooksOnTheRadio, all one word. And I respond to both.
Amazing. Okay. So you can get links and show notes for this episode of The Enthusiastic Cast at TheEnthusiasticCast.com. That's without the. You can also find an archive of past episodes on the site, as well as the occasional blog post. John's probably posting more often than I have lately. If you want to drop us a line, our email address is correspondence@enthusiasticcast.com. Until next time, thanks for listening. I'm Mark.
I'm John.
Cheers. I'm John.
Awesome.